A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to a bonus episode of Chopper's Politics Podcast, recorded live here at the Red Lion Pub in Westminster. This may well be the last time you hear my dulcet tones, listeners, as we record this podcast on Tuesday the 4th of July after a pint of black velvet with the former BBC chairman. More on that later. If you don't know, and if you don't, where have you been for the previous 360 episodes of this podcast with our 8.2 million listens, I'm Christopher Hope, the Associate Editor for Politics at the Daily Telegraph, and it's great to have you here. On today's episode, a simple proposition, an exclusive interview, the exit interview, with Richard Sharp, the outgoing chairman of the BBC. We chatted about bias, the future of a licence fee, the dangers of Twitter, and a certain Boris Johnson. I started by asking Richard Sharp one question. Why are you resigning?
Well, I stepped down from the BBC because I formed the view that I couldn't do the job that I'd arrived to do.
Just the noise of the reporting,
yeah,
of what
look,
happened.
The BBC faces a huge amount of challenges, and that was what attracted to me in the first place, because I thought I could bring my existing experience to bear on the BBC to help it develop and change in a way to be competitive. And you have to form a judgment, if you're the chair, can I remain effective in seeking to do what I want to do? And the judgment has to be made in the interest of the institution.
Was the noise that forced you out created by the BBC itself?
No.
You recognise it was legitimate reporting of what happened?
Absolutely, absolutely. I said it once, the BBC does have a reputation for 360-degree firing squads.
Yes.
There was a substantive issue that needed to be reported. The way the story developed, it had consequences.
Yes, we'll come to that.
Yeah.
Did you feel sad you're leaving earlier than you expected?
Yeah, of course, because the job isn't finished.
No.
And also because I enjoyed working with the people at the BBC, and it's just, everybody has that sense of fulfillment if you know that you're having a constructive effect. And I certainly felt that I was making the right level of a contribution, had a terrific board. I really enjoyed working with the people at the BBC. It was a new challenge for me. So I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I felt I was doing something purposeful, and I was doing something purposeful. So that's obviously why I'm sad to leave, because I felt I had another year and a half to contribute.
Do you wish this guy, Sam Blyth, never got in touch?
Look, I think I've known Sam for a long time. He's a friend. I wish I'd had a better
minute conversation maybe with him.
No, I should have said, sorry, mate, can't help you. I know it's the pandemic, but you're going to have to find your way to Case on your own. And I can't do that. That was an error of mine.
And Simon Case, the Cabinet Secretary, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What would you have done differently? You'd done that thing you said.
That would have been helpful. Would have been helpful.
And what were you doing in number 10 at the time? You were advising Rishi Sunak, weren't you, as Chancellor next door?
No, I was brought in during the pandemic. Actually, the reasons why I ended up at the BBC is a result of the work I did. So, for example, I created one of the most successful interventions, which was the film insurance scheme, which had 100,000 jobs going. Films kept going in this country where they didn't elsewhere.
That was COVID support.
It was COVID support. There's been an independent conclusion. It's the most effective COVID intervention. I was also the architect of the Culture Recovery Fund, which kept the entire culture industry going. But also I had the opportunity to take my private equity skills to bear. So I helped with the development of the National Infrastructure Bank, which hopefully will continue to work forward on that. Also the Life Science Venture Capital Fund, because that's a critical industry. And we'll come to that later if you like. And also just reported a few weeks ago, I helped structure the CELSA capital that went in from the government, and the government got all its money back plus interest. So that was effective. And then I also helped with the financial support for Rolls-Royce and for British Airways, and also discriminated where money shouldn't go. I felt very proud, actually, yeah. of the contribution.
And you're doing
I
things, and it's so hard to know you're doing things of value in government.
Well, the Treasury team were terrific. Mm. You know, they're working round the clock on the pandemic. And I have to say that I'd heard in the past that people from business couldn't work effectively in government. I found that experience
Unpaid role, was it?
It was unpaid, yes. But that, if you remember at the time, I know I got the call in March, I guess, 2020, from Rishi, would I go in and help? And of course, you know, at that time, you know, we were facing catastrophes.
As the wave of the pandemic broke over
correct,
the country.
Correct, yeah.
And then so you went in number 11 or your Treasury?
I was in number 11. So in fact, I felt as a result of meeting and spending time with the film industry and with the culture industry, I realized how central, you know, the creative arts are economically and for our future. And then when the BBC situation arose, when Charles Moore withdrew, and a friend of mine who's an actor sort of said, look, you know, you could really, I thought, well, actually, this is another area I can make a contribution. Yeah. And I'm sure like you and like almost all of your listeners, the BBC has helped define who we are as individuals and as a society.
Yeah.
And coming from the commercial background where I'd had some commercial media experience, I did recognize that BBC needed to reform and that I could actually potentially add value. And so that's why I applied.
And you got the job when? That was in when you were given the job, 2021?
I think I started February 2021.
Hmm. And it was going really well. You enjoying it?
Yeah.
Lots of meetings and you got into the structure.
I mean, I spent a lot of time challenging the BBC.
Yeah, yeah.
But what was gratifying was how welcome that was.
Yeah.
And that told me that the BBC, the people of the BBC recognised, and obviously they should do because they're consumers of whether it's Netflix or Prime or Spotify, they recognize they're living in a highly competitive digital world, and they also recognize that a bit of external DNA would be constructive.
And that's the point of a chairman. But by then, you'd already had this contact, hadn't you, with this businessman, Sam Blythe, and you hadn't raised it when you were being interviewed for the job.
Yes, exactly.
And that became your undoing. But you had raised it with Simon Case verbally.
Well, look, obviously, yes, Simon Case is the head of the Cabinet Office, and within that is proprietary and ethics. I had a conversation with him. You know, it was a short conversation, and he was flat out in the middle of the pandemic.
Yep.
But I was having the conversation with the head of civil service. Well, I took comfort from the fact that he said I wouldn't be involved.
Yep.
I raised the BBC issue with him. I took comfort from that, and what I should have done was over-communicate. Because 9 months later, something happened. But at the time of my going in to meet the committee, I, you know, clearly should have over-communicated and said there's a conversation I had with Case which could give rise to something which could be perceived in a certain way. And that error was mine.
When you say the committee, that's the MPs who were signing off the appointment?
The recruitment committee and the MPs. Now, as you will have seen, the Heppenstall said that failure of over-communication didn't invalidate the appointment.
No.
So that error wasn't in itself the reason for the resignation. The reason for the resignation was entirely to do with a judgment about, as a consequence of all that happened, could I be effective as the BBC chair?
And it became harder and harder. Have you talked to Simon Case? His notes of that conversation didn't include the words BBC on his
Well, after the story broke, I had a brief conversation with him. I'd understood that subsequent to that conversation, he then looked at his notes and wasn't sure what he could recollect. And if people want to look at the appendix in the Heppenstall report.
Did you feel let down by him? He was your alibi. He was the person who would say, it was raised with me, and I said, don't worry about it.
It would have been helpful if he'd had a better recollection, but, you know, it is what it is, right?
Yeah, recollections may vary, sadly, in this case. Are you surprised? Didn't he keep a fuller note about the importance of what you were saying to him?
He's Cabinet Secretary. No, and bear in mind, I didn't take a note.
No.
I was communicating with him.
And there was a lot on at the time.
It was the end of a long day. This was during the period that people, if they weren't going to work, had to stay in their homes.
Yeah.
It was an under-resourced number 10, number 11. Mm. I was working flat out. He was working flat out.
So was it a chat in the corridor or was it in his office?
No, I went to a meeting in the Cabinet Office, but it was maybe a 15-minute meeting.
About something else?
Yeah, but it was a 15-minute meeting. So would he have had 20 things that day to deal with of massive importance?
Yes.
Absolutely.
And no one's with him, so no one was there with him.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to labour this point, but it is so important to why you had to leave in the end. I mean, were you worried about embarrassing Boris Johnson? Is that why it wasn't raised when you interviewed by the recruitment group and also the MPs.
But the issue was, I thought as a result of my conversation with Case that it had been dealt with.
But you didn't raise it when you were being formally interviewed for the job latterly.
I wasn't a time traveller, so at that stage nothing had happened.
Exactly.
There'd been no communication, nothing had happened other than my saying, this guy Blythe is going to call you because he'd like to do something. There was no knowledge of whether something would or wouldn't happen. And so, to my mind, having raised the BBC with Simon Case and him saying, fine, I took false comfort from that.
Yes.
I think he was saying fine in relation to me and him, and I should have thought about, was it fine in relation to the people interviewing me?
Yes.
I just, at that point, I felt I'd been dealt with.
But the Blythe conversation wasn't raised when you interviewed formally for the job.
That's right.
And you, why didn't you raise it with the MPs in public or with the...
Because at that stage it was just a conversation. I didn't know anything was going to happen. I didn't.
Yeah.
I felt I'd communicated the case and obviously wrongly. I should have ever communicated.
Do you think you became a lightning rod for what I call Boris derangement syndrome? People just go a bit bananas. Anyone near Johnson is at risk.
Well, look, first of all, the BBC itself is incredibly important as an institution.
Yes.
So I think that's possible. Plus, we're operating in a rather febrile political environment.
Yes.
And I'm more used to the commercial arena. I'll let other people judge, you know, whether the noise was proportionate. Obviously, I'm partial in that, I think.
Was it proportionate? What's your view?
Look, I think if people bothered to get to grips with the facts, they would see why Heppenstall said, in itself, it doesn't invalidate the appointment.
Yes.
And he also said, I was not involved in facilitation. I wasn't involved in any loan. And he wrote, I'm happy to report that.
Yes.
So it was entirely confined to simply asking for Mr. Blythe to be in contact with the Cabinet Secretary, which it turns out, actually, as it happens, never happened.
Yes.
So,
but you still resigned, though.
Of course, because by the time the thing got reported, my presence could have challenged a perception of the impartiality of the BBC, because people don't understand the role of the chairman. Mm. There's a lot of confusion. Mm. I mean, even sophisticated people think somehow the chairman gets involved in editorial decisions. And therefore, you know, for example, some people on the DCMS committee would have felt that.
Mm.
So there's a lot of ignorance about the role of the chairman and the role in governance. But you've got to deal with ignorance as it exists. And the consequences of the controversy meant that, particularly going into something, you know, with a general election or the rest of it,
yes,
then any time the BBC would report one way or another, people could question its impartiality.
Who leaked it?
I don't know.
A chat between you and Simon Case in a room and no one else is there. How does that get out?
I've no idea. You would know better than I do.
I don't know better than you.
You are the reporters who...
But you know how the circle of knowledge
is spread. Well, let me put it this
way.
I suspect that I wasn't the target.
No, you weren't.
You know, you conform judgments.
You were collateral damage.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Have you spoken to Boris Johnson since all this happened? Has he said?
I had a brief chat where he said, what the hell's going on? And I said, well, it is what it is. And that's basically it.
You went to see him in Chequers. You've been named against the Chequers during lockdowns. Are the police in touch with you about this?
No.
No.
No, it was, well, it was, we met in a garden, had a conversation, and I was batting for the BBC, so I'm perfectly content with what happened. And that was after I'd been appointed as the chair.
Do you think as a Tory supporting chairman of the BBC, there's always a target on your back at the BBC?
Well, look, I think the short answer is there's always, I mean, when there was a Labour supporting chair, there's a target. Yeah.
Gavin Davis. And
correct, exactly. Back. So yes, I think the short answer is yes.
More than if there's a Labour supporting it, Chairman.
No. Oh. No, I think that it's sufficiently important an institution that whoever is the chair, you know, is vulnerable, let me put it that way.
Mm. Why do it?
Well, I mean, good people should apply. It's an institution that critically matters, full of talented people.
It does matter.
And it needs to survive, and it faces existential threats.
Yeah,
so
we'll come to those in a minute. But your mates are thinking, looking at you, Richard, going, Richard, you had a stellar career at Goldman Sachs.
Yeah,
you've done all this stuff. You've got your charity work. You know, you've dabbled in politics a bit. You're giving money here and there when it's supports. But why expose yourself to this? Is the question that you might be asked.
I mean, look, it's this. First of all, it's a great country, and it's been good for me and my family. And I come from, you know, two or three generations ago, refugees coming to the country. So I really appreciate it. I think it's fabulous. I think that I've had benefits as a result of being here. And I think I come from a family culture and all the rest of it, which is give back. So that's why after the crash, I went to the Bank of England on the Financial Policy Committee in terms of financial stability. And that's why I got involved in the Institute of Cancer Research and other areas. And
there's public service, public service.
And that's why I do believe that if people can bring to bear their skills with public service, they should seek to do so.
What would you advise yourself if you go back, as your time travelling, if you went back to the end of 2020, you'd say, Richard, don't take the job, or would you say...
No.
You don't regret your 2.5 years?
No, of course not.
Because you've been chairing the BBC.
No, but also, I think they're fantastic people. I've learned a lot from this experience. I'm a bit older and wiser than I was. I hope I haven't lost my sense of humour. But at the same time, it's been a painful period for me. But no, I think people should, and I would hope to myself, continue to do public service if you can.
Well, we'll come on to your plans for the future in a second. You don't feel any sense that the BBC staff are out to get you?
No, it wasn't personal.
And
I think,
but being a Conservative friend of Boris Johnson,
well, no, because,
could be a thing for the BBC, maybe?
I mean, look, journalists were certainly talking to people at the BBC.
Yeah.
And I think what they found out is that anybody who interacted with me at the BBC felt that I'd been effective, independent, and impartial in everything that I did. Mm. And so I was actually gratified by that. And, you know, had there been any sense of me not being an effective chairman,
yeah,
the press would.
Well,
have
no one said that.
Exactly. So I think the BBC period has been a good period for me, and it hasn't ended the way I wanted to.
No.
My concern is I hadn't finished the job.
Yes.
And there's a tremendous amount of work to do, and for the BBC to survive and thrive.
Was the reporting proportionate?
Of what?
Of you, of your situation, the BBC.
Well, you know, I'm partial.
What do you think?
I think there are other things going on, like a war in Europe. You know, massive potential conflict between China and the US.
Cost of living crisis.
I was surprised to find myself as lead items on this issue, but that's editorial independence for you.
The BBC would have reported it the same way had it been a Labour supporter.
Totally.
I mean, yes. You think back to...
Well, they had a duty, in fact.
To go over the top, maybe.
To be seen to be independent and objective, and I respect that.
Yeah. Is the BBC biased?
Is the BBC biased? No. I mean, the BBC...
Against the right, which is what the right always tell us?
Look, from time to time, the BBC will make mistakes here and there. And you and your listeners think about things on a partisan issue in terms of political parties. I think most people are more concerned with the bigger issues. So that's why we have the BBC's addressing partiality, and that's why we did tax and spend review, getting to the fundamentals. Also, there's going to be one on migration. Mm. So I think... The issues are that the BBC needs to be a platform which presents truth. And there's no doubt in my mind, particularly with the leadership of Deborah Turnus on the news side, but also Charlotte Moore elsewhere, that impartiality is the number one issue because it's also a fantastic opportunity for the BBC to define itself. In a live reporting environment where we have global distribution on radio, on television, on the web, will mistakes be made in headlines and articles from time to time?
Yes
but this is the critical issue. Critical issue is the BBC now got a mentality which is constructive when it reviews, if it makes mistakes, how it addresses them and fixes them? And I believe it does.
And culturally, the big complaint from people who leave the BBC and then say what it's like at the BBC is they say culturally there's a left-leaning bias within the structure, the people who bosses hire people like them, and you have this...
When I arrived, and I asked people about this, they said two things. First of all, they said the BBC felt it had got it wrong on Brexit in terms of it hadn't really understood the country and reflected the country back to itself. That's the people of the BBC. The other thing the BBC people told me, which I don't think many people disagree with, is that the media industry, people who go into the media industry, tend to have a left of centre position. Mm. So then the question is, in doing their jobs, do they bring those biases to bear? And what I do know is that with... what has been, if you look at it, a quite interesting 10-point partiality plan. Mm. The BBC is doing everything it can to address that.
Yes.
You know, whether it's whistleblowing, whether it's addressing groupthink, whether it's impartiality reviews, and raising the importance of impartiality as defining the BBC and how we deal with complaints, etc., etc. So whatever the individual feelings that people have, I do believe the BBC right now, certainly the BBC that I was part of, is seeking to be impartial in everything that it does.
Did you challenge it when you were internal there, when you were in there?
Well, of course, there's...
You would say, the chairman would say, well, what's that about?
There's an editorial guide... Well, there is an editorial guideline standard committee. Post-broadcast, there have been processes that are run by the executive, but at the same time, they do define the brand and they are of strategic importance. So in terms of the impartiality plan, having non-execs and external members of the editorial guideline standards committee, which does review complaints, is reviewing where they're getting put. That committee is very important, but that's all to do with both what we set out in terms of the rules of engagement for the people, and then looking and analysing any breaches
yes.
after they've
Did
happened.
You ever complain personally about anything when you were there?
No.
But you probably felt like you couldn't because you're the chairman, it would be me.
No, I think that if there had been something, you know, egregious, I would simply would have said to Tim, are you across this? And Tim would say, yes, I'm across.
So you think the BBC isn't biased towards the left?
No, I don't think it is. I'm a centrist myself. Mm. Whatever people, you know, have their all people have their
received. So Boris Johnson, I
believe. What? Well, I don't know if he's a centrist or not, but I certainly am a centrist. And I think that's where the BBC sits. Mm.
And therefore, it annoys both sides, doesn't it?
Well, it provides due impartiality. It doesn't necessarily have moral equivalence. Mm. You know, when people process information, when they consume it from the media,
yes.
they do with their existing opinions. And if it's at variance with their point of view,
yes.
then they may see it
as a bias issue
from their own bias. So the BBC will continue
yes.
to get criticisms.
Yes. I hope you don't mind me asking. You mentioned your Jewish heritage, and I'm afraid there's anti-Semitism claims were part of the reporting of this. Mm. The cartoon by Martin Rowson, who you were at school with, a grim picture. Have you spoken to him?
Oh, no, I haven't, no.
No. And do you think that was part of the reporting at all?
Not at all, no. No, I think that was unusual and unfortunate.
So looking ahead to the BBC's future, should the next chairman be not a party donor to any party?
Or chairwoman.
Or chair, forgive me, chairperson.
Exactly. Chair. I don't think being involved or caring about politics in this country should disqualify people. I do feel that as a result of my own experience that I had in the media industry beforehand, and I'd started a YouTube channel, I'd been an advisor to media companies. In fact, I'd looking at bidding for ITV with Greg Dyke in the past, etc. In my private equity world, you know, sports rights and other media investments. So I had experience in the sector, and I don't think the fact that I had donated to the party, and I think the last party donation was 2010, should have disqualified me. But it does mean that in the recruitment process, they need to assure themselves that the chair person will take as a primary objective the strength of the BBC as an independent organisation and which should behave in an impartial manner. So there will be questions to be asked if somebody is partisan.
Yes.
For example, an ex-politician. And we've had politicians.
Yes, Chris Patten.
Right. So but the critical issue is what is the function in this governance of the chair? And the chair is there to be part of the non-executive, to hold the executive to account. The executive execute. The non-execs do not execute, and this is the misunderstanding.
But why do governments of different colours appoint chairmen, chairpeople, chairpersons who are similar to their view, their worldview? Well, Labour did it, the Tories did it.
Well, no, look, Gavin was in conflict, you know, so...
Gavin Davis. Ex-Goldman Sachs banker.
It may have been that his wife worked in Downing Street,
yes,
but he was forced out by Number 10. Similarly, I had accusations... Number 10 were irritated with me that I'd gone native when I was batting aggressively for the BBC.
Yeah. You may have over the licence fee. And
licence fee and other things. So yes. it's around the individual and their competence to be a chair in this corporate governance mode. Do they know what it is to be chair of a corporation, to be competitive with Netflix, competitive with Spotify, Amazon, Apple, for the BBC to succeed globally? That's what they have to have the competence to do.
That's where the challenge is. Would you advise your friends to apply for the job? Who's asked you so far?
No one has asked me yet.
Would you advise them to go for it?
Yes, I would.
Yes.
I mean, I'd say, look, you know, think very carefully about the nature of the political environment in the UK with the extraordinary sort of angertainment that exists in the political discourse.
Gosh.
Where
what does that mean, angertainment?
Well, I think Malcolm Turnbull coined that phrase, which is news is turning into angertainment, in the desire to actually get clicks and connection... or clips and connection, there's now a different tone in the discourse which has a lot of ad hominem attacks, fair and unfair. Mm. And unfortunately, we're in that situation with an organisation like the BBC in a way that I'd personally underestimated, and that's what I'd say.
So just be ready for it.
Yeah, and make sure you and your family know what you're getting into.
But the benefits are huge, of course, as you say. That's the negative. The benefits are huge.
Well, the benefit is...
That you're shaping the national conversation at the top of a...
But also, I know, but this is of... I think the success of the BBC is of global importance.
Yeah.
take the World Service, for example. We can get into the funding of it, which needs to be fixed, and the government needs to play a more active role in it, away from license fee payers. But the real issue is the BBC has a fantastic opportunity to deliver truth globally and to be a valuable form of soft power where digital communication can be more powerful than bombs and rockets in terms of shaping the global political discourse and therefore addressing issues like conflict and driving values like democracy forward.
You mentioned the World Service there. You're concerned about the funding of it because...
Yes, totally.
Because the value of it globally, the soft power level...
Yeah, I call on the Foreign Office, the DCMS and the Treasury to recognise when Osborne put forward taking away from the government the funding of the World Service, the BBC, that may have been fine then. It's not fine now. And because the BBC is short on terms of its capacity to deliver competitive content, funding for that, particularly as a result of the licence fee. And it has a duty to the licence fee payers to deliver content to them in their households. And that is not the World Service. But the World Service itself is of massive national importance in terms of our soft
international,
power.
International importance.
Yeah, but national in terms of our global soft power.
Yeah.
So for the UK's place in the world, the BBC can play an extraordinary role in the perception of the UK. I mean, it's one of our strongest global brands, and it's a means for us
to... So what needs to be done? A grant, annual grant to replace the
yeah, the I think the government...
100 million, what's
the grant? I think the government needs to take on. I think it's going to be...
To take it over.
You know, I mean, if you look at the billions that the Americans now are putting into it, the Chinese, the Russians, the Turks...
Into
broadcasting and digital communication in their part, propaganda. Truth needs to be there to counter it. The BBC is an extraordinary vehicle to do that with a legacy brand... Mm. And very capable journalists, a global workforce able to deliver.
To hive it away from the BBC?
No, not at all. Fund it properly. And we start ahead of the game. We have the best brand globally. Mm. So to defund it is an act of global harm done.
And self-harm by the UK.
I think so, because I think the BBC being successful is good for the UK.
The licence fee is a big debate. It's up for review. You're nearly leaving. We're in the pub. No one's listening to any of this podcast. What can replace it? Or should it be replaced?
Well, I need to come back to something you raised before. Why does the government get involved in the appointment of the chair? And that's because currently we have a mandatory payment of a license fee. And we operate in a democracy. Mm-hmm. And from time to time, we have elections. And the BBC needs to be held to account by Parliament. And one of the ways to do that is to have representative of the nations in the chair that are effectively appointed by the government, which has a mandate from the people. So that's the connection.
So you're the democratic wrapper almost on the BBC.
Well, but that's why the government gets to make an appointment. But once appointed, they have to act in the interest of the BBCs. So I think there is a logic behind it, that it's not self-appointed, but the representatives of the people get to choose. In terms of the actual mandatory payment, there will be a charter renewal. I happen to be in favour of it. I think of it, the BBC as a public service broadcaster. In a world where societies can get polarised, just look what's going on in France right now. The role of media and role of a media to counter social media is incredibly important in terms of education, social cohesion and universality, which is not driven by commercial terms. There are ideologues who have a legitimate view, I don't agree with it, that people should just be free to just buy what they want. And to my mind, they're missing what a public service broadcaster brings to the fabric of society. And then the other dimension is it's a secret weapon in terms of driving competitive advantage in the creative industries in the UK. And that's one of the industries for the future in terms of our success as a nation and our economic development. So I think the BBC fulfills both a cultural role in terms of society, but also an economic role, and that's underestimated.
And that's understood, but how should we be paid for is the question.
Well, and so I would be in favour of a form of a mandatory payment. Currently the licence fee, one issue which is it's regressive. Flat for which may need to be addressed.
So poorer people have to pay
the same price.
How would you? So you have a different scales of it? Would you link it to income? Or
my last board meeting was last Tuesday.
Yes.
So I think it's too early for me. I'm still too close to some of the analysis that I've seen to be able to communicate where. But
you've left it. You left at the end of June, so you've left the BBC.
Yeah, the end of June wasn't that long ago.
Okay.
I know a day is a long time in politics.
You could have degrees of licence fee, couldn't you?
Yeah, so you can look at models around the world. There's broadband tax, there's household tax, and on council, there's licence fee. Mm. change itself is disruptive in terms of moving from one mechanism that maybe works to another. And there are challenges. The two challenges, obviously, are that it's regressive and also that the collection process can fall harder on women. And that's because women are often answer the door when you do inspecting
who's paying.
Correct. So it's imperfect. The question is there a better system and what is the disruptions going to be caused to changing it? And this is for a debate for Parliament.
Yeah, yeah, I know, and politicians.
Now, I think both sides broadly support the BBC. So I think there are, as I said, ideologues who have a different view, but I think they're in the minority. And then it's up for the BBC to actually deliver content. So when it comes to the charter renewal, it remains an important part of household entertainment, communication, education.
Surely it should be decriminalised, though. That's the big issue for those on the right, is the fact that you can be prosecuted for not paying the licence.
You can be, but it's one of these issues, which is the sanction itself drives behaviour, which means you don't need...
There aren't many prosecutions, are there, is the point. But for the individuals who are prosecuted, it's
correct. Whereas if you go into the civil litigation, you actually can increase the amount of litigation that will take place. So it's not as obvious as you think. Of course, there's a natural emotional reaction, which is why should there be a sanction? Mm. And then you get a common good. As a result of people paying their licence fee, you get a common good, which is you get an incredible value for what people are actually paying on a household basis. So if you think about radio, the websites, you think about sports, think about children.
And we've all got a stake in it.
Exactly.
That's why correct. You're here. But, I mean, yes, you're not the chairman of Sky, you're the BBC chairman. And then
Well, I'm not here as the BBC. I was the BBC chairman last week. I'm not the BBC chairman.
But the point is everyone has a stake in what you do and
correct.
What you say. And that's,
absolutely.
That's part of the conversation.
Yeah.
Gary Lineker. You've left now. What's your view of him? Should he be
great goal scorer? Fantastic commentator.
Great commentator.
Yeah.
Good podcaster.
Yes, very good, and also obviously a good entrepreneur in terms.
And a big critic of government policy. Is that okay?
Well, look, there is a review going on.
Yeah,
it's going to go to the Director General and the executive team. They will then present it to the board, and clearly there's something that needed to be addressed.
Yep.
And you know, social media engagement is changing over time. This has given an opportunity for the BBC to reflect on where it needs to be with freelancers versus employees, news, non-news, and bring it together more systematically.
And sign up to some kind of charter, depending on your status with the BBC.
The internal report hasn't been completed yet, but when it's done,
What are your plans for the future, Richard Sharp?
You know, I've enjoyed, as I said, the engagement with the media industry. But at the same time, during that period, I put into a trust some of the other business interests I had.
A blind trust.
Yeah, so I'm now going to actually this week engage with it. And some of the areas that interest me are medtech. Mm-hmm. One of the teams I'm working with is a team of mathematicians who are bringing algorithmic strength to a number of different areas and disciplines. And I'd like to get involved with that, particularly now we're entering an AI world. And then I'd like to think in some way the kind of, if you like, successes I had when I worked in the Treasury would indicate, or the Bank of England, that there's still an opportunity for me to help
with the government
public sector, well, just in some under a government of either hue. To me, I still believe in public service. And if I can help out, now I am involved in, you know, a refugee advocacy organization, one also in terms of giving advancement to underprivileged children in terms of career advancement as well. So I'll also get more involved in some of my philanthropic and trustee activity.
Rishi Sunak said he was mildly miffed, was the quote, when you took the job. Would you want to go back to work with him? He's your old friend from Goldman Sachs.
He did want me to stay.
He knows you from the old days.
He used to work for me.
Yes,
And you know, I have a lot of respect for him, and as I also do for the leader of the opposition. But I'd rather stay away from anything that has a political angle to it.
Might be wise.
And although I obviously respect his competences fantastically, I'd prefer to have public service that plays more to my commercial skills and stay away from the political arena.
Do you think, looking back, you were naive in any sense? At one point was not making a full note of that chat with Simon Case, possibly.
I mean,
were you too trusting?
No, it's a brutal
world, isn't it? I mean,
look, as I said, Margaret, the error was mine. Of course, I've looked back at it and thought, God, what a bloody idiot. Right, okay. I mean, you know, because...
I think you're being harsh on yourself. I mean, I think...
But what Heppenstall said, it wasn't a conflict. It wasn't a perceived conflict.
Yeah.
It was a potentially perceived conflict.
But you felt you had to walk, and I wasn't clear why you had to walk at the time.
I had to walk because my presence and the controversy itself meant that when the BBC was reporting, people would attack the BBC. And what was more important in making that decision was the BBC, not Richard Sharp. And that was the right thing to do.
Yeah. I'm leaving the Telegraph for 20 years, off to GB News. Any advice?
Well, you mentioned that you're going to take time off. And as you were saying it, I was thinking to myself, I'm not sure that's wise. I think it's a fantastic opportunity for you to engage with broader developments around the world. Because if I'm a critic of you and maybe this sort of area, we're sitting right in the heart of Westminster, is that there's an incredible myopia, which really means everybody's looking at trivial things around this area rather than some of the more fundamental things that matter. And they are big things going on out there. So I'd say...
Well, AI being a big thing.
Well, one of the reasons we had the tax and spending partiality review, because the question is our discourse around some of the economic challenges we have focused on the right
but
things?
That's in the BBC, wasn't it?
But there's a reason why I drove that. It's because there's a lack of knowledge. And if you look at the hierarchy, there's data. Data leads to information, okay? Information leads to knowledge, but knowledge doesn't mean understanding. Above knowledge is understanding. So the question is, people can certainly have the information about what's going on. In order to report on these issues effectively, you need to have understanding and arguably wisdom and technical knowledge to bring the arguments to less about personalities and trivia and focus more on the fundamental policy issues. And these really matter. And I think that there's around, whether it's this issue, whether it's migration or other areas, it's an opportunity for you away 5 weeks.
Yes, I should have think about
to that. Actually research and think and get to grips with the bigger whatever you regard the bigger issues are, and then bring your political analysis to bear with that level.
Is what you're describing there? So that review you're describing there was the frustration for some people on the right might be that the question is always led: what can the government do? When in fact the government shouldn't do things. Sometimes is that?
No, I think it's more that the arguments often default to trivial issues rather than the more substantive issues and getting to grips with the detail. And I think that's because, you know, reporters are stretched; they're operating well with a lot of things going on, and they default to their comfort zone, which is around personalities, because that's often more interesting than the substance. By the way, it's bloody hard to get to grips with the substance of economic policy, debt to GDP, fiscal deficits, currency movements, balanced payments deficits, twin deficits. These are tough issues, but right now they're relevant in a high inflationary world where we're worried about growth and productivity, and that comes back to what defines welfare for people in it. Unequal society.
Back to you though. What have you learned about yourself through all this? You've been through the mill. It wasn't something you didn't think it was coming, but it did happen. What have you learned about yourself?
I think probably to anticipate the unanticipated and take a step back, to be wiser than I was in terms of the situation, and also I think to be philosophical. You know, own your own mistakes, which I made, and I probably haven't made the last mistake in my life. I just this one was.
But you're learning from them,
of course, of course, and that's okay.
How will history remember Richard Sharp, BBC chairman? He tried his best. He did some good things.
Though. I feel comfortable that I've accomplished a lot in the last couple of years. Do I feel there's a legacy effect of my presence at the BBC? Absolutely. It's got an outstanding board. The executive have been, I think, we've engaged incredibly constructively in challenging conversations around budget, around getting fit for purpose, capital allocations, things that were never addressed before. So I think I've left it in a better condition than it was when I arrived. It just is the job hasn't finished yet.
Well, Richard Sharp, just recently, until recently, chairman of the BBC, thank you for joining us this week for my last ever Chopper's Politics Podcast.
Well, congratulations to you, and I hope your future brings success, albeit that it's with GB News.
Thanks, Richard. It was at this point that Richard had clearly enjoyed himself so much in the Red Lion pub that he ordered a round of black velvets, that's Guinness and champagne. So we tucked in. Why not? It's my last ever podcast. Well, it's now gone 11 o'clock, so I have a drink. It's my first actual proper drink in this pub.
Well, there you are. You
see. Yeah, doing this podcast. We haven't really done this before.
Oh, really? Okay. That surprised me. Now, very, very slowly, because otherwise it's...
Exactly. A round of, well, half pints of Guinness. We're now mixing it with champagne to create black velvets, which is an excellent way to end my time at Telegraph drinking black velvets with the former BBC chairman at the Red Lion pub. We're some great friends. This is great. Dominic, well poured.
Domenico is doing a fantastic job.
Why do you like black velvet, Richard Sharp?
It tastes good and it feels good.
Yeah.
And it gives you iron.
It gives you iron. It's got vitamins. It's got vitamins in.
We all need vitamin B12s or whatever it is.
Yeah. And Richard Sharpe, do you think that Twitter drives too much of the political discourse?
Look, Twitter's incredibly valuable. And I think the world without Twitter for a moment. So they rightly describe it, if you like, as a global town square. But at the same time, the question is, do the journalists have a proportionate view of what they hear on Twitter versus where society is as a whole? And I think that's the issue. The issue is that Twitter often amplifies extreme views, and the journalists and politicians who spend a lot of time on Twitter need to make sure that they have a sense of balance. And I don't think we're quite there yet as a society.
So put the phone down. Well, and talk to people.
I think Elon Musk recently told people that they need to have a life as well as Twitter. It's about balance and perspective. And I think we've gone through an era of engaging with social media where journalists and the media probably have a distorted view as a result of engaging with Twitter, and they need to get a little bit of balance.
And that's all for this week's Choppers Politics podcast, listeners. The final ever episode. Blimey. If you want to get your fix of Chopper, I'll be gracing the airwaves of GB News from mid-August as their new political editor and head of politics. I hope to see you there. Thank you to my guest this week, Richard Sharpe, the former chairman of the BBC. Thank you to my producers over the years, Andy McKenzie, Theodora Louloudis, Louisa Wells, Giles Gear, Elliot Lampitt, and many more. For more insights into the wonderful world of Westminster, please do turn up to the Telegraph's Daily Politics newsletter. It arrives straight into your email inbox every weekday, and the link for that will be in the show notes this episode. One thing that will carry on at the Telegraph is my weekly Peterborough Diary gossip column, out every Friday at 7 p.m. online and in Saturday's copy of the Daily Telegraph. Please do keep reading it. And from me personally over the years, thank you for listening. Without your support and feedback and loyalty to this podcast, it simply wouldn't have happened. It started back in March 2017 with an idea to have something to mark Brexit and why Brexit happened. It was called Chopper's Brexit Podcast. It became Chopper's Politics Podcast because guess what? Brexit was done, sort of. And here we are, 6 years later. I'm a bit greyer, but I've had a great time, and I can't thank you enough. And as always, please do buy a copy of The Telegraph, if you can, where you can. I know you won't regret it. But until next time, cheerio.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.